Yes, I'm an archaeologist. So the debate that we just had in the discussion section there was perfect for setting up my talk, because it was a debate, theoretical debate, about the pros and cons of fire. I'm an archaeologist. I excavate sites, and I'm interested in looking for the evidence, the actual evidence for fire. And what I'm going to do in my time today is I'm going to try to convince you of this sentence right here, that Neanderthals were not obligate fire users. So Amanda made the point that we are obligate fire users, and the question is, when did that come about? And I have a good data set for Neanderthals, and so I want to look at whether or not Neanderthals were obligate fire users. Now, to make this point, I have to emphasize something that Amanda said. I need you to sort of suspend the need we have for fire today. I need you to think about a time when maybe fire wasn't absolutely essential. And the reason I need you to think about that for a minute is because otherwise my talk is very short. I show you when the oldest evidence of fire is, and then we just say, well, then after that, all human societies had fire. And what I want to do is instead say, well, maybe there was fire at times, and at other times there wasn't. And that it came and went and was used in different ways at different times. And what we're interested in is, well, how did Neanderthals use fire? And when did, more generally, when did fire become essential to our adaptation? Now, I came into this question in part because of these papers, by Richard Wrangham and colleagues. And in these papers, they present a lot of very convincing data that talks about the things that we've been talking about here, that says that if you cook your food, you in effect increase your energy budget. You get more out of your food when you cook it. And it's the experiments and the data presented seem to me anyway very convincing. But then when I went to the sections of these papers where they turn to the archaeological record and say, okay, what do we see in the archaeological record to support this idea that cooking would have been essential to the human adaptation, I was unconvinced, and it didn't match what I feel like I see in the archaeological sites that I excavate. Now, a paper, a really important paper on this topic was done by Will Robrooks and Paolo Villa a few years ago, and Will Robrooks was the one who was supposed to be here preceding my talk to talk about his work, and especially, I imagine, this paper. And what they did in this paper is they looked for the archaeological evidence for the origins of consistent, systematic use of fire. And they did a really clever thing. They looked at all the kinds of different types of evidence that you might have for fire. So they looked for hearths, but they also included burned bones and burnt lithics and other measures that suggest that there was fire in the archaeological site. And they did a very extensive review of the literature, especially of Europe. And what they found was, when they put all these data together, is that they pooled the number of sites with good evidence by fire by time intervals, and then showed sort of the frequency of fire through time, and created a graph that looks like this, where there's not much evidence of fire before around 300,000 in Europe. And you have to remember that people came to Europe long before that. So people came to Europe without fire and existed for hundreds of thousands of years in this rather difficult climate without fire. And then around 300,000 years ago, we start to get sites that have evidence of fire, and it increases through time like this. It's a very nice paper, and I think I don't challenge the data in this paper at all, but I have to make two observations about it. First, when we make just about any graph of something from the archaeological record, it looks like this. Okay? So it's hard to find things that are old, and it's easier to find things that are more recent. And it's very difficult to correct for this when you make these kinds of graphs. So right away, I'm sort of suspicious, because the shape of this graph is the shape of really any graph we're going to make of anything from the archaeological record. But for today's talk, what I want to emphasize a bit more is this notion that I don't dispute that there's evidence for fire, but when I zoom in on that and look a little bit more closely, I see a record that looks more like this. It's not continuous. Even if it's frequent, it's not continuous. There's gaps. There's times when you have no evidence for fire. Now, let me walk you through why I think that's the case. So my data set comes from especially Southwest France, the classic region around Les Aisies, a number of sites that we've excavated over the years, and another site here, called Jonzac. And especially, I'm going to talk about these two sites right here, Pestalozzi and Roc de Marsal. Sorry, I'll explain in a minute. So Pesh is a site we excavated for 4 years, from 2000 to 2003. It has a long sequence that represents about 60,000 years, from 100,000 years ago until 40,000 years ago. And at the base of this sequence, there are these thick layers that preserve evidence of fire. The other site that I want to emphasize is this nearby site of Roc de Marsal, which has a slightly more compressed sequence, but there's still tens of thousands of years of time in this site. And I want to emphasize that. Tens of thousands of years of time represented in these layers. And I think you can see, again, here at this site, at the base of the sequence, there's plenty of evidence of fire. So we have flints that have this pop on them called a pot lid that shows that they were heated. And we have these nice stacked hearths, one on top of the other, showing that there's lots of evidence of fire. Now, if you're going to look at quantitatively evidence for fire, you would think you'd focus on hearths. And here are some nice hearths from Roc de Marsal that we tried to expose, several of them on this surface. The problem is that hearths are not always preserved. A hearth is kind of a fragile thing in the archaeological record, and it can get disturbed and blown away or transported away by water. It's not a reliable indicator of fire. You could have fire and then have this evidence removed. So instead of focusing on hearths for my talk, what we've done is we've focused instead on looking at heated lithics. So when you light a fire in one of these sites, the sediment itself is full of stone tools and bones, and those stone tools and bones then get heated by the fire. And the fire, especially on flint, leaves very distinctive marks. So you have these what we call crazing and pot lids, and it has a tendency to break the flint. It's not always recognizable, but there are these features that are clearly recognizable. So the research is quite simple. You go through all the stone tool collections, and you count how many flints show evidence of being heated. And as I said, we've also done experiments. We understand how heat moves through sediments. In experimental conditions, we vary the sediments, we create fires on top of that, we measure the depth that the heat goes into the sediments, and so we have some idea already that if there are fires, the heat should penetrate the sediment, and it should heat these lithics and allow us to then quantify the presence of fire in these sites. So when we do that, we get data that look like this. So here's Pestalozzi on the right, and here's Roc de Marsal on the left, through time in these two sites. And as you saw from the photos before, in the lower layers where we see evidence for fire visually, we see hearths, we also have a high percentage of heated flints. But then, especially at Pesh 4, we have substantial period of time where we don't have any evidence of fire, or very little, very trace evidence of fire in these layers. Okay? So some layers have fire, but a lot of layers don't have evidence for fire. And when I pool all the data sets that we have, the ones that I showed you before, plus a couple others, the histogram, the distribution of layers with heated flints looks something like this. The vast majority of archaeological assemblages that we have from these late Neanderthals have very little to no evidence of fire as measured this way. And some have a bit, and then only a handful have really strong evidence of fire. Okay? So now why is that? Why is fire missing from these sites? Well, there's a lot of reasons that that could be, but I'm going to talk about a few of them. One is poor preservation, so the evidence just simply isn't preserved, and that's what usually people criticize this data set for. But there's nothing that would make burnt flints go away, right? Flints are hard, they're durable, they last forever. So if there was fire, if they were heated, we should see it. So that explanation doesn't work for this data set. A better one maybe is that we excavated the wrong part of the site, right? That we excavated here, but all the fires were over here. And that's a good criticism, and I'm going to address that. The other one that's a good possibility is that the site function changed through time. Or maybe site function varied over the landscape, and we excavated the wrong sites, right? That these sites weren't used for whatever activities fire were required for. Those were at the other sites that we didn't excavate. That's a harder question to address, but I'm going to try to tackle that one too. And then finally, well, Neanderthals didn't always use fire. They were not obligate fire users, okay? And the challenge of my talk, I have to say, is that I have to try to prove something from the absence of evidence, and that's really difficult. But let's just take a look at this a little bit more. So here's Pesh 4, and here's where we excavated. And the cave is in the cliff face is in the back here. And Francois Bord, he excavated a huge portion of this, and then we excavated some more. And this shows you where the fire is, and it's a little bit under the drip line, okay? But there is a problem, I will admit, with this site, is that over time, the drip line retreated this way, okay? And so maybe the fire also retreated this way, and we're just missing it in the upper layers, because everything just sort of shifted back along the cliff face. But that explanation doesn't work with Roc de Marsal. Roc de Marsal is a nice cave to excavate, because it's not so big, right? Here's the outline of the cave coming like this. Here's where an archaeologist excavated before, a guy named Jean Lafitte, and then where we excavated in blue. And you can see we pretty much captured the cave, right? We have it from the front to the back and across the central portion of the cave where fire would be. For us to have missed fire in the upper layers, it would have to be jammed up against the wall somewhere. Seems unlikely, okay? So, site function. I will confess to you that archaeologists are really bad about reconstructing what people did at a site, okay? Some might disagree, but I think that we don't have any clear way of saying exactly what activities took place at that site, and especially these Neanderthal sites, they look very much the same through the whole sequence. There's ways we can try to address it. This is a pretty bad way, I have to admit. I'm just looking at tool types, scrapers, notches, other kinds of tools. At Roc de Marsal, we can maybe see a relationship between the kinds of stone tools they were making and whether or not we have fire, but it doesn't work at all at Pesh de Laz. So sometimes they're doing one thing, sometimes they're doing another thing. It doesn't seem to correlate at all with whether or not we have fire at that site. There are some things that are interesting, though, and that may help us explain this. So one thing is not the kinds of tools they made, but the kinds of flakes they made, the technology of flake production. And there's this one technology in particular called Lavalois. And when we plot all our sites, we can see that when we get fire, it tends to be associated with Lavalois. Not always. You have Lavalois sites with no evidence of fire. But when you have low Lavalois percentages, you don't have fire. Okay? So there's something going on there. Another thing is when we look at the fauna, we also see a kind of a triangle-shaped graph, a bit of a trend here, where when you have high percentages of reindeer, you don't have much evidence for fire. When you have low percentages of reindeer, that's when you get a lot of fire. There's one data point here that worries me a little bit. That one has a fairly high percentage of fire and a fairly high percentage of reindeer. I'd like to have new faunal studies on that. But there's still a general trend there that I think works. Now, the thing about reindeer, you won't be surprised, is that reindeer are most associated with cold environments. So it's completely counterintuitive. It's exactly the opposite of what we think, is that this is a measure of climate, the Delta 018. When it's cold, we get sites with reindeer. When it's really warm, we don't. And we can look at that. Sorry, we can look at that at one site. Here we are back again at Pestalozzi, and it translates to the heated flints. And what we're seeing is that when it's cold, we don't have evidence of fire. And our best evidence of fire is when it's really warm. When we put all of our data sets together, we get a thing like this. So here I've got the different sequences, best we can, placed into a chronology, and I've got the environment here. And what I can see is that when I'm getting fire, it's in the warm periods, and when I'm not, it's in the cold periods. I'm going to just throw in one more site because it's a really important one. Nearby is a site called Congrenal. It's important because it represents the last 100,000 years or so of Neanderthals in southwest France. It has a very deep sequence, a lot of layers, and when we look at it there, pretty much the same thing, right? When it's warm, we have evidence of fire. When it's cold, not so much. There's one nice outlier here that I'd really like. The Congrenal is being re-excavated right now, and we'd all like to get down into that layer and see what's going on there, because that might tell us something a little bit more about the context under which Neanderthals made fire. So I was feeling a little bit out of it because I didn't have any equations in my talk, and all the other talks have equations. So I made an equation. And so when you have reindeer, what's going on here is what I'm trying to explain. When you have reindeer and you don't have Levallois, it's most often a kind of middle Paleolithic that we call Kena Mousterian. I'm going to use the Kena Mousterian to try to prove a point that it's not because we've dug the wrong sites. So Kena Mousterian is very distinctive. It is often associated with these, what we call bone bed deposits, just thick mass of bones, all right? And these bones are normally reindeer bones. And here you go, close up of this thing. And so just stacks of reindeer bones and these very distinctive stone tools, Kena scrapers. And Kena scrapers, archaeologists can recognize these, right? You can spot a Kena Mousterian by the kinds of stone tools they make. And wherever we look at the Kena Mousterian and all the sites we have here and in other sites that people have looked at, you don't see evidence of fire. So you've got this Neanderthal adaptation that seems to be associated with the coldest periods in southwest France, where they're hunting reindeer, they're bringing them back to these sites, accumulating these big deposits of reindeer bones, and there's absolutely no evidence of fire in these things. So let's put it all together. I would argue that we're missing evidence of Neanderthal use of fire. And I would argue that in this case, the absence of evidence may in fact reflect behavior, that it's not just simply a product of the archaeological record, that this pattern is real, and that we have substantial periods of time when Neanderthals weren't reliant on fire. And as a result, the use of fire was perhaps not a species-level trait in Neanderthals. So maybe some Neanderthals in some regions were using fire regularly, but in other regions they weren't at this species level, which is important because of the things these guys have been talking about up till now, about species-level traits and energy budgets and physiology and so forth. And so Neanderthals did not necessarily need to cook meat, and they did not need fire for warmth, even in these really cold periods. And I would summarize that as Neanderthals were not obligate fire users. Lastly, I would put out an appeal to understand Neanderthal fire use. We need better data when there is evidence for fire. That's what archaeologists tend to report. They say, I have evidence of fire. But we also need to report when we have no evidence of fire. To understand this pattern, we need to know where fire shows up in the archaeological record, but also where it doesn't. So I'd like to thank a number of people. This research is particularly motivated by Dennis Sandgate, Paul Goldberg, Vera Aldayesh, and Harold Dibble, a friend of mine who we lost yesterday. Thank you.